So here we are, and this is another CommUniversity Lecture Series presentation. And so we have the brother, Dr. Jared Ball, who we appreciate, who has come to us all the way from Morgan State University's campus. And so for those who might not be familiar with Brother Ball or may not be familiar as much with his work, he's a professor of communication studies in the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University, and he's also the founder and curator of media platform imixwhatilike.org, and it's also here on this slide as well. And he'll be speaking with the topic at hand today, the myth of black buying power. The myth of black buying power. And so, as he comes before us, let us open our minds. Let us embrace the importance of critical thinking. If we need to take notes, let us do so. If we need to sit up and posture ourselves a certain way so we can internalize and receive the information, let us do so. But just want to remind everybody, if you have a cell phone, if you have an electronic device, if it chirps, if it buzzes, if it whistles, if it rings, if lights flicker, let's please do what's necessary so that way we can be present for this conversation and we can be present for this presentation so there's no distractions and there's nothing that would hinder us from being able to maximize what it is that this brother is going to bring forth today. So with that being said, let's sit back, let's relax, let's not relax too much, all right? We don't need any snoring or anybody to fall asleep, but yet let's be comfortable and embrace what it is that this brother Hart has worked hard to research, what it is that this brother here has worked hard to delve into by way of his topic, the myth of black buying power. So without further ado, without further delay, please give a warm blacktastic welcome for brother Dr. Jared Ball. I shake and give it up.
All right. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
First of all, I greatly appreciate the invitation to present on this topic, and for all of you to come out for coming out and missing the prince's wedding. I know you were struggling with that one. It was a tough choice, but. No, but in all seriousness, first of all, I appreciate the invitation. I appreciate the effort of all those involved here. And before we even get started, I just want to give it up for the ancestors, but just a quick other mention that, again, today is the 93rd birthday of Malcolm X, and I think that is a great concept for which to have this discussion. I want to say from the outset, I don't have the solution. I just want to be very clear. The first thing that people usually say to me when they hear my argument on this is, well, but what's the solution? And I'm saying I don't have one. I would also be cautious of anyone who stood before anybody and said that they singularly have the solution. I think that's always a warning flag should go off. But my real point is I've only in this instance wanted to isolate and try to, in the parlance of Bob Brown, shotgun a particular myth. The solutions to all of our problems will only come from the kind of work exhibited in this space, collective, political, organized, clear work. That's the only vague hope we have. The details about what to do will come out of that and out of that understanding and work that is generated as organized political groups in off the record. That was deep. What was that?
Siri.
Oh, NSA? Okay. Good. As long as we know they're listening. In fact, thanks to the FBI's surveillance of my father, I actually learned a lot about him that I would not have otherwise known. So I appreciate, thanks everybody. Thanks FBI. Anyway, that's another discussion. So I wanted to just be very clear about that. I don't have the solution. I just think that this particular issue is confusing efforts to get to any solution you might get. Similarly, I also want to say from the outset, I am not saying and do not mean to be interpreted as saying that we should not try to support black business, black endeavor, black entrepreneurialism. I'm not saying that is not a goal or shouldn't be a goal. I'm just simply going to argue that that in and of itself will not get us anywhere. That in and of itself, that path is not one that leads to collective salvation. All right, so again, I don't have the solution. I'm just challenging this one particular myth, and I'm not saying don't support black business. This is often the critiques I get when people think they've heard what I've said. So I just want to be clear about that, and we'll come back to that. Now, for me, this started a little over 10 years ago when, in fact, this is the 10th anniversary of the first effort of my own, and which I still think is the first effort, period. And I don't mean to sound arrogant here. I just think that this has been a particular myth that has gone unattended for so long that I just happen to be the first, really the only person to ever really challenge this particular idea and concept. And over 10 years, in writing and researching it, it has led to more hostility for me than anything else I've ever been involved in. And to me, it's not even anywhere near the closest what I would consider radical or threatening or provocative argument or position I take politically. It just happens to be one that is extremely, for a lot of reasons that I think we'll come to, difficult for people to accept or to rationalize, in part because it is such a heavily propagandized myth. And we're going to talk about it in terms of propaganda and the process and how propaganda works. And because of that, it is successful. Now, I tend to try to start with some basics in terms of context. So I'll talk a little bit about this, and I'm happy to come back to it during Q&A. By the way, if anybody needs me to stop and repeat something or has a quick question, please just let me know. I'm happy to address it now. Otherwise, I'll come to everything. I'm happy to get into a more deep conversation when we get to Q&A. With everything, for me, I start with the colonial premise. That is, that everything we're ended up, that I argue, Lisa, that we end up talking about is about the process of colonialism. And that just simply is, in this case, or specifically a group of Europeans conquering the world over the last 500 or 600 year process, creating colonies, external and internal, to any particular country. Black America, what we call Black or African America, was itself created at the same time Europeans were colonizing the rest of the world. And I like to make this point in particular because, one, I think it helps us reassess and reconnect us on a radical Pan-African path when we realize, again, that every African or every nation of the African continent was itself being created, most of which after the creation of a black internal colony here or an African internal colony here. In other words, African people placed and colonized here should be seen as exactly same part of the same imperial process that created all of the African countries on the continent and all of the so-called Latin American countries in South and Central America, and really created the geopolitical map that we see on the world today. It's all, in fact, every nation in the world is itself a direct or at best an indirect response to European imperialism. So none of them are authentic to the groups of people they claim to house. So in other words, Nigeria is no more an authentically African space than Baltimore. And they were both created as part of the exact same process. So when we're talking about Africans in the United States, yes, there are obvious differences, but we have to understand that we exist here as part of the exact same process as every other group around the world. I also like it because it returns Black America to that world stage. That while we do have some particular special experiences that are unlike elsewhere, we are part of a global population.
That's right.
All right. In the context of imperialism and colonialism, we can only understand media in the context of what those who control it have said for themselves. Those in power have argued and developed this phrase here that media are to give them what they call full spectrum dominance. So the same way they're conquering land and territory and oil and whatever other resource, they want to use media to conquer the rest of the territory. So they said they want to control cyberspace the same way they control land, air, sea, and outer space. All right. So media are not just here. They're not just... That is really deep when that happens. When you're not ready for it, it's just wild to hear that as a wow. And I know we have a tendency to see media as entertainment, or it's just a movie, or just a song, but I want to argue that none of that is true. And in another context, another discussion, I would argue often that if you, especially in this context, whenever you like a movie or a song, you should be more critical of how it got to be in front of you in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying don't like it, just be more critical of it. You know, why do I like what I like, and how do I know what I know, is usually what I offer, ask my students, borrowing from an old professor of mine. I'm not saying don't like what you like, but do endeavor to critically investigate why. All right. I like you put the echo on that.
Yeah.
You're thinking, he's like, similarly, in terms of media, we have to understand that, though, now again, this is another area that usually I struggle with in terms of these presentations. I'm not arguing that each and every one of us is permanently and consistently bamboozled by every media message we get hit with. I'm not saying that. I'm not trying to make anyone feel less than. I am saying that those in power have been very clear in their own words that they want media to manipulate us in our consciousness and our public opinion. They work very hard and work with spend billions of dollars every year. In fact, the advertising industry spends almost $700 billion a year just to mess with us. That's just one industry. But they're engaged in what they call propaganda, psychological warfare, or psychological operations, or public relations. These are all euphemisms. They all mean the same thing. And that they are the primary means of social control. So Fanon, as we'll get to in just a minute, Frantz Fanon would say, one, that colonialism is the entire conquest of land and people. That is all. So that's what we're talking about, just conquering. But he would also say that there's a two-pronged method. There's the physical method. You first come in and wipe out whoever's going to stand up as a warrior, wipe them out. And then the bigger work, actually, is manipulating the minds of everyone who's left standing. The physical stuff, on some level, logically, is even easier, and in some ways, in terms of carrying it out practically, is easier to kill a bunch of people than to keep them alive but manipulate them so that they don't become a threat. That requires more work, which is why those of us in the United States are the most heavily propagandized people in the world, by far, in human history even. Fewer people control more ability to reach us with their media product than ever before. They have greater penetration and reach, more control, tightly owned controlled, and with a greater ability to in a sophisticated way, really mess with us. All right, so I just want to start with that. And then again, because it's his birthday, or just in general, Malcolm is always worthy of discussion. We have to remember this basic point. The media is the most powerful entity on earth. They have the power to make the innocent guilty and make the guilty innocent, and that's power, because they control the minds of the masses. And he was as right then in 1964, I think, when this quote was said, as he would be saying it in 2018. In fact, now it would be even more so. The media system today makes what was going on back then look like, you know, I don't know, Sesame Street or something. Something real simple. All right, the function and development of mythology. Just a couple points on that as we're talking about the myth of black buying power. In this great book about Kwame Nkrumah, this point was made by Ahmad Rahman. The process of colonization was itself a far-reaching psychological operation called psyops in the parlance of modern warfare. Propaganda or myth-making and symbol manipulation were the colonialists' essential catechism for centuries. Colonialism itself was an ideology of combat. The metropole's propaganda, symbols, and myth-making were as crucial as bullets in the effort to pacify the colony. I love that quote. But that's exactly right. It's not just words. I mean, I say this in my class all the time. I mean, it's really simple. Like, if you just think about the ability, like Huey Newton defined power as the ability to define phenomena and have it act in a desired manner. So I ask my students this. Now, imagine this. In this moment, I am defined as a presenter, you are defined as an audience, and we are engaged in a relationship. But just imagine what your behavior would be right now if, for some immediate reason, the definition of me or my presence here changed from presenter to hostile assailant. How would you all behave?
Where's that?
Defensive.
Not a rhetorical question. Would you sit there? With your pen on your pad? What do you say? He'd be aggressive. He's sitting there with his little man on his lap. He thinks I'm a threat is a problem. In other words, you're all behaving in a certain way based on the public opinion set or the definition set of this moment.
Yeah.
If so, just imagine the ability to manipulate that definition. You can make people do anything at that point. And this is essential. You can't just kill people and put a gun to their head and say, do what I want you to do, because then they'll resist. History's very clear. As soon as people realize they're being oppressed, the resistance is almost immediate. And those in power study this. So they're saying, we can't just keep doing that because they fight too much.
Uh-huh.
Dang it. They fight.
Right.
Now, this book, John Potash is this white dude from Baltimore County who's done some of the best research on the history of Tupac Shakur. And he put me onto this book years ago. And I always give him credit for this because this book is a monster. If you want to understand anything about any of what we're talking about today, you got to get this book. And I think she even updated it a couple years later. This is the Cultural Cold War, the CIA and the World of Arts and Letters, the Cultural Cold War. And what Frances Stoner Saunders does in this book is she brings it out to a macro European context. And she talks about how England and the United States after World War II worked to just basically set up a global cultural propaganda matrix where they would create magazines and TV programs and make it about art, seemingly about art and entertainment, but all of it was about politics and putting ideas against communism, and they would set up book reviewers to write book reviews about books coming out that might push people in a certain direction. And their point was, we have to be everywhere. We can't just be shooting these people. We have to set up an entire apparatus that will say something else is happening. So I read this quote, it's a little long, but it's worth it. Propaganda was defined as an organized effort or movement to disseminate information or a particular doctrine by means of news, special arguments or appeals designed to influence the thoughts and actions of any given group. A vital constituent of this effort was psychological warfare, which was defined as the planned use by a nation of propaganda and activities other than combat, which communicate ideas and information intended to influence the opinions, attitudes, emotions, and behavior of foreign groups in ways that will support the achievement of national aims. Further, the most effective kind of propaganda was defined as the kind where the subject moves in the direction you desire for reasons which he believes to be his own. It is useless to dispute these definitions. They are littered across government documents in the dunes of American post-war cultural democracy. In other words, she's saying there's no point in arguing this. You don't have to believe it works on you. But there is no argument here that this is what they are trying to do because they have said it and put it in all their documents everywhere. They've been very clear. And in one of my favorite books called The Science of Coercion, about the history of the communication system in this country, everything has been set up. The field of study I teach in now, communication studies, was specifically set up by the political and economic elite to study how to manipulate people and create new citizens and create all kinds of things. Walter Lippmann said specifically, white people need negative images of black people as a self-defense mechanism. He said, we have to make black people look bad. Otherwise, we can't feel good. I mean, he said it. And then I'm like, he's saying it. And people are like, well, it don't affect me. I'm like, it doesn't matter if it doesn't affect you. I just want you to understand that there is an attempt being made and why. All right. So as we start to transition to the specifics here, and I'm happy to come back to any of this during Q&A or whenever, if you like. A new study, and I was very happy about this. I admit it. From the jump, I was very happy that this new report, a major study that came out of Duke University with all the big name scholars on it and some of the more popular, like Antonio Moore, I don't know what you would call it, pundits, this great report. And I'm proud that they cited my work in this, in part because I've been ignored for so long and hated on for so long without anybody saying why he's wrong. It's always slick. They're just like, Jared is wrong. Why? It just don't sound right. He's just hate. He don't have no solutions. All right. Or my favorite one, he's mixed, so he can't talk about black people. So my godfather said, my godfather, I love him to death, he's short. So my godfather said, when they say that to you, then you say to them, he said, they used to say that to me all the time. Well, you're just a little one from Cincinnati. And he was like, well, what would you say then if I was tall? Right? So in other words, if I was the blackest, most blackest, 100% blackest, black, and made the same exact argument, what then would you say was wrong?
Too black.
Now you're too black, yeah. That's it. But the point is, nobody will say, here's what he said, and this is where I can prove he went wrong with his analysis, and this is why we need to listen to somebody else. So that's why I keep putting this work out there. It does not help my career. In fact, quite the opposite. It does not make me any money. I promise you that. It doesn't make me popular. It doesn't do anything for me other than the selfish desire to put something accurate out into the world and know I'm right. And to try to make some sense for other people. But anyway, so this report cites my work, but it more fully encapsulates all that is wrong with the economic analyses that we often hear about why black people aren't really doing as bad as you think, or that the reason black people are doing so poorly is because they are themselves incapable of figuring this out. So what we get wrong with the racial wealth gap with lead authors William Darity, Derek Hamilton, argues simply, by the way, please go to imixwhatilike.org for more on all of this. I should have said that from the beginning. My full work on the buying power thing is up there. This report is linked up there. There's so much stuff there, and it's all free. Just, you know, whatever. Video, audio, whatever. The racial wealth gap is large and shows no signs of closing. Recent data from Survey of Income and Program Participation shows that black households hold less than 7 cents on the dollar compared to white households. The white household living near the poverty line typically has $18,000 in wealth, while black households in similar economic straits typically have a median wealth near zero. This means, in turn, that many black families have a negative net worth. Now, we have to understand at least this very basic point. Now, I would love to talk about capitalism. I would love to talk more about how economically the system is designed specifically to create the inequality that we have. Capitalism requires poverty. It requires suppressed labor. Everything we're seeing is necessary and functions perfectly for capitalism, because that's how you get the wealth that is now being accumulated more and more at the top 0.1% of the world's population. So that's how you have 5 white people in this country who have more land than all of black America combined. That's what we're talking about here. So this is not an issue of black people just don't know how to spend money and save money. This is an issue of policy, of histories of imperialism, of government and state influence, of capitalist aggression, of white supremacist hostility. I mean, this is the result of systems of oppression. It's not about anything else. So what this requires is, and those who study propaganda know this, that more than anything, you need more propaganda. Noam Chomsky says that you need more. He says propaganda is to democracy what violence is to totalitarianism. So the more free a society claims to be, the more you have to propagandize them. Because if we're in an unfree society, I just come with the gun and say, do what I tell you to do, and you do it until the revolution starts, and then I lose, then I have to learn how to come back with something else, which is create a system of propaganda that makes you think you're a citizen, or there's hope, or if you save, you can be free, or if you buy black businesses or put money in black banks, you'll be free, or all of these things that are nice steps to take but will not improve anything.
What's that again? Propaganda is to democracy?
Propaganda is to democracy what violence is to totalitarianism.
Thank you.
You need more propaganda. That's why we are the most heavily propagandized country in the world, because we're told more than anybody how free we are. That's how you should know we're suspicious. As soon as somebody says, man, you free, you should be like, stop. All right, now I know you hustling me now. Like, when somebody's too nice to you on the street, it's like, okay, what you want?
Right.
What you want? Come on now. Stop it. Brother, bro, you look good. Oh, man, here we go. Here it comes. All right, so these are the myth basics that I've broken down into three, and I'm going to read them, and then I'll come back and break them each down and go to how I've concluded they are myths. Myth one, or basic part one. The claim that African America has roughly $1 trillion in buying power is popularly repeated mythology with no basis in sound economic logic or data. While the myth has a larger history, it is today largely propelled by misreadings and poor or false interpretations of Nielsen surveys and marketing reports produced by the Selig Center for Economic Growth at the Terry College of Business, housed in the Bank of America Financial Center in Athens, Georgia. That alone should cause flags to go up. Mm-hmm. The people who are telling you how rich you are Bank of America. Mm-hmm. The shady... and I want to say, I have to be checked on this, but I think, wasn't Bank of America the one that was started to help former Confederate white folks after the Civil War get themselves back on their feet?
One of the banks.
Wasn't it one of those?
Mm-hmm. J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, so, you know, but they're telling you, you know, it's like when the New York Times tells you, you know, which black leader you should follow. Or Washington Post gives your analysis on Dr. King. That's what this is. So number two, buying power is a marketing phrase that refers only to the power of consumers to purchase what are strictly available goods and is used as a measurement for corporations to better market their products. The word power here has nothing to do with actual economic strength, and there is no collective $1 trillion that black people have and just foolishly spend ignorantly to their economic detriment. Yeah. It just doesn't. It doesn't exist. That's why I started at the beginning with that wealth piece. Black people don't have any money, and what we do have is what we have after we've paid whatever we're gonna pay, or when we don't pay a bill, we have a little extra, and then we can only spend it on things that are available to us. So when people say, "Man, stop buying hair and rims and all of that, otherwise you'd be rich," well, no. I'm buying rims because I can't invest in stock. I'm buying hair because there's no land for me to buy, and I can't invest in AT&T. Fanon put this beautiful years ago. Colonialism leaves us the trinkets to purchase. We that's what we're left with. Or I'll come back to this also. We can talk more about this also, but it's the same thing. Like, I can get a $30,000 loan to buy a car, but I can't get a $30,000 loan to invest in property or open up a business. People will give you money to buy what they want you to buy. And if you pay more attention to what's happening in this country isn't making anything tangible anymore. So the biggest product is financial service now. So if you notice more and more when you go to buy something at a store, they're not just trying to sell you a shirt, they're trying to make you buy a credit card or you know, get some credit, because that's where they make their real money. The shirt you're buying in the store isn't making them money. The credit that you use to buy the shirt is what makes them money.
Interest rates.
It's beginning with interest rates, and because the products themselves are made overseas. But that's right. I still get called that. This country doesn't build anything anymore. It only creates debt and financial service. So that's why you can get a credit card now. That's why, you know, that my favorite car commercial, you know, out in your D.C., your car is your credit, your job is your credit. You can get a car. You just have to have a job, and they'll put you in a car. But you can't go with that same job and get money to invest in, you know, something that's going to create wealth for you. That's the myth. So then the third myth is, that the myth of buying power functions as propaganda. Oh wow! It functions as propaganda. And specifically to make people think that their poverty is their own fault. So that's why you often hear reference to this buying power thing. The myth of buying power functions as propaganda to deny the reality of structural, intentional, and necessary economic equality required to maintain society as it is, one that benefits an increasingly decreasing number of people. To do this, the myth functions to falsely blame the poor for being poor, poverty the myth encourages is the result of the poor having too little financial literacy, or as resulting from their bad spending habits, when in reality poverty is an intended in result of an economic and social system. The simple, I mean, just look at the history of Donald Trump. He inherited wealth, inherited business, and then when he went broke, his name got him more loans to reinvest and buy more business to get his money back up. No one in this room can do that. You go out and fail as a business, that's it. That's it. There's nobody coming to you who's going to then... In fact, they were saying that Trump was just like the corporations on Wall Street. They're too big to fail. He was too big to fail, so they had to reinvest in him because his brand was too big around the world. So he literally couldn't go broke. They were like, we're going to invest in you. We got to keep you afloat. All right. So again, this first myth is a misreading that we have this buying power comes from the Nielsen surveys. And what is Nielsen? You got to look up. I mean, we have to come back to that. But Nielsen is itself a company that is itself in the business of producing reports for other businesses. And I'm going to come back to that point because this is where we get caught up. So this is how it works. I mean, this is an example of how this myth gets spread and developed. Reports like this one come out every year in one form or fashion. Nicely styled, pretty system on the cover. Talking about black people are going to do well. Look at it, we're resilient. They keep coming back. Relevant. But relevant to who and on what basis? So $1 trillion? Where does this number come from? So this is what the report says. Despite historically high unemployment rates, I had to emphasize that. You got to read that. Despite historically high unemployment rates, blacks have shown resiliency in their ability to persevere as the consumers. Black buying power continues to increase, rising from its current $1 trillion level to 1.3 by 2017. Now, how does a group of people with high unemployment rates, historically high unemployment rates, somehow economically powerful and strong?
The other means of, generating money.
I hear you, but I don't agree. My point would be that the reason that we're being told we have power and relevance is not because we actually have $1 trillion that we can spend any way we want. It's that we have, well, I'll show you here. I'll show you what the next thing is. Black buying power continues to increase, rising from its current $1 trillion. First of all, we don't have $1 trillion. And this is what I'm trying to show you where that number is coming from. The second thing is that the power they're talking about is not the power to take money and use it however you would want to use it. It's the power to enrich someone else. So if I'm the corporation, I'm saying you're powerful, not because you're powerful in the way you conceive of power. I'm saying you're powerful because you're powerful to me in your potential ability to buy my product maybe versus his or hers. Do you see that? I'll try to build on that difference, that subtle difference going forward, but it's an important difference that continues to confuse the situation. Yes?
So now, what is that number always compared to in regards to white wealth? They say we have $1 trillion. How would that measure with white wealth?
That's a great question. They don't compare it to white wealth because, as I'm going to show you in a minute, this is not a measurement of wealth. And as I showed you already, we don't have any.
Right.
So they don't even talk about white buying power. What they do is they talk about different segments of... So, that's a good question. Let me do it this way. Buying power is broken up and applied to a whole bunch of different groups. So they'll put out buying power for millennials, buying power for the LGBTQ community, buying power for, generation whatever, for older generations, buying power for corporations, buying power for a city. Buying power for Amazon. Jeff Bezos just had a conversation about Amazon's buying power. It was in the room. And what they're saying is, again, in those discussions, and I'll show you this in a moment, they're all being honest. This is not about economic power as we are taught to think of it. It's, again, about a number of things. The ability that they have to buy products that the people creating these reports are trying to sell. Or it's... I'll leave it there. That's basically it. It's not that they. It's not that they're saying. And then they're never saying, for instance, that the LGBTQ community could overturn all of whatever it's dealing with if they just saved and spent differently. Or the Latinos would be different if they did this. Or Native Americans. They actually said Native Americans have like $100 million of spending power. People live on $2 a day. What are you talking about? Well, this is where I'm trying to show you. So this is where the numbers are coming from. The Selig Center. And how do they get that number? Now, what I'm going to show you here, I got 10 years ago from the reports before they put them behind a $125 paywall. One, I don't really have that kind of money, and two, I also don't want to spend it if I did on this report, so I'm struggling. I should get it so I can further prove my point to get the updated versions. But I'm suspicious this is why they've done it. Not just because of me, but because anyone can start to see how they come up with this buying power concept. So the Selig Center defines buying power as disposable income or the total personal income available for spending on goods and services after taxes. Further, simply defined, buying power is the total personal income of residents that is available after taxes for spending virtually on virtually everything that they buy, but it does not include dollars that are borrowed or that were saved in previous years. Now that causes a lot of confusion, because then are you saying that if I borrowed money on a credit card in 2017 and spent a bunch of stuff on 2017, that in 2018 the debt I'm still paying on that doesn't count? Or that it doesn't count towards...
Oh.
Or are you saying, or similarly, are you saying that you are counting what I'm buying on credit cards as buying power? Because there was some debate, I had some debates with people over that too. Because to me that was the clearest one. If you're counting buying power what I'm buying on a credit card, then we're clearly talking about something phony. I can't be rich then, because obviously we all know this.
Right.
Buying stuff on credit cards is not power. Does not. But then similarly, this is how they. So let me start with this first part. So partially what they're saying is, and this is where they try to convince people that we have all this money, because they're saying we're calculating all the money you have and that you spend after you pay for taxes. Well, if we look at. So Antonio Moore did some good work on this, but the standard number is, the last time I looked, the standard number is that the median black household wealth is less than $6,000. $6,000 for the household. Antonio Moore and Sandy Darity and others did this work that showed that if you really count it as it really should be looked at, where you're looking at things that don't really have value, it's really about $1,700. A study just came out a couple of weeks ago that said that I think I misheard it, but I want to say it was something like 90% of people in this country don't have even $600 in their savings account. That number may be a little high, but at the same time, I was like, how many people do I know have actually $600 right now in their account? I got to see how close to payday I am. Or how long would you have $600 in your bank account would be a better question.
That's a better question.
Because as Walter Mosley put it, that the simplest way to put it is that if you can't quit your job right now and live exactly as you live for at least 2 years, then you're poor. Now, 2 years, I don't even, I'm like, 2 months, 2 weeks, I don't know, like, we missed one check and the whole house is like, we got a two family house, like a two income household, like on paper we make money, but
on paper,
like relative to the average working family, we look good, like they, like on paper, but one check,
yep.
that government shutdown happened. We was like, oh. All right, anyway. So they actually try to confuse it by saying that we actually have this money. And after we pay our bills, we run out and go shopping. And if we just shop differently, we'd be all right. But on the right-hand side, this is really how they were calculating buying power, because it's not based on real numbers, because black people don't have any money. And that's, again, why I started with those wealth and income disparity numbers. And there's a lot more to say about that, and it's worse than that, but I'm rushing at least a little bit. They said black population growth suggests that buying power will be better. Why? Because they're saying more black people will be here, so more black people here, more black people shopping, more buying power. But nobody trying to assess the actual economic strength or condition of a community would simply say they're getting bigger, so it's automatically better. No. No. Increased job opportunity. Well, yes and no, because as we saw, and as the Economic Policy Institute put out in its study a couple years ago, it said that black people are in a permanent recession, that even when the economy is doing well, black people are doing not well. So even when things are good in the country, black people don't do well. So how is getting more jobs necessarily going to mean economic strength? Number one, if the jobs, when we look at the numbers, show that black men and women are routinely paid less than their white co-workers, the jobs they're getting are not the high-paying jobs, they're underemployed, and all these, you know, so are you getting a job and counted as being employed, but you're only working 20 hours a week? The numbers are funny, so you have to look a little more carefully. They're just simply saying more job opportunity, more education for black America. The report I just showed you shows definitively that the more education you have does not translate to more money. Black PhDs are earning less than white people with high school diplomas. Mm-hmm. And what percentage of black America has a PhD? Anybody know?
About 2%.
Not even. Mm. The last study I saw said black PhDs, they put N/A.
What?
Not even applicable. Not even a sizable enough of the percentage of the population. So that's why I used to joke with my client, like, you should look at it like it's unicorns. When you see it, it's like a unicorn. And then look at the situation, though. I owe $100,000+. Do you know the student loan people told me? They told me on the phone, they said, one of you or your wife should quit your job because the two of you make too much money to apply for the forgiveness you need because you can't pay your bill.
Wow.
So I said, wait a minute. I don't even have to go any further. Just think about that. So get the education, but then quit the job I got because of the education because I can't afford to pay off my student loans. Wow. I said to the lady on the phone, do you hear what you're saying? How?
You don't have to pay them off.
All right. Only 8.1% of black America is over 65 years of age or at career pinnacles at which wage increases decelerate, whereas whites are 13.5% over 65. So they're actually saying because black people, there are fewer black people over 65, black people are economically stronger. But why are there fewer black people over 65 than white people?
Because we die.
Because we're dying, because we get killed in the streets, we don't have health care. We are the one study showed that the level of PTSD in black people living in America is as high as soldiers fighting in combat.
Wow. Absolutely.
We are fighting combat.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
So you have but somehow Nielsen and Selig are twisting this into something that makes black people powerful. Black people spend more than non-blacks on natural gas, electricity, phone service, footwear, and higher proportions of money on groceries, housing, and women's and girls' clothing. There was a study that came out around the time this report came out that showed, I forgot the exact numbers, but it was showing like 70 or 80% of black and brown people are spending almost all of their income just on housing. So no wonder we're spending more on housing and groceries because, as was shown even after the Freddie Gray incident, the local grocery store is charging more than the big supermarket that's farther away. So of course black people are spending more on groceries and on housing, etc. But this, they say, is a sign of economic strength. This is how they're trying to convince people that this is a sign of strength. Why? Because they're talking to the people that own the grocery stores, that own the houses, and own the girls' clothing. So they're telling the producers of that, of those clothing, and the producers of the telephone services, and the owners of the electric company, this is what black people mean to you. We read this and are taught, this is what this means for us. And this is a big problem. Yes, sir.
Quick question.
Sure.
One second. Okay. Anybody from now on, just use the mic, because we record. Okay.
I need to stand up.
You can just spin around.
Quick question, my
man. Sure.
When they define wealth, I'm not sure if you know or not.
I'll figure it out. Go ahead.
When defining wealth, yeah. Do they define it as a house being paid off or still paying on it?
Well, first of all, that's another good question because, as I forgot to highlight here, They're telling you, this is where they're most honest, in this line here. Buying power is not a measurement of wealth. That's why I even highlighted it there and forgot to read it myself, or emphasize it myself. So they're not saying, see, so this is where at least they're being honest. They're not saying you are wealthy. They're saying this is not about wealth. So which should again tell us, stop using this buying power stuff to assess our economic condition, because we have no wealth. As I showed you earlier, we're zero. So they're saying this is not a measurement of wealth. And any honest assessment of economics is, to understand the true standing of someone, is wealth, not income. And for anyone confused, the simple difference is income is what you're paid for services and going to work, and wealth is what you make off of other people going to work and paying you. So as I tell my students, when I go to work, I get a check, and then I become a sieve. And through me, that check goes to the phone, to the mortgage, to the babies, to everybody else. That's income. And I have to go to work for that. The people who collect that payment on the other end, not the person on the phone that you end up yelling at, because they're just another worker. I'm talking about the person they work for. All they've done that morning is wake up, click, yep, yeah, paid. All these other people paid. Money, 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 money. Now invest that in something else. Buy up some more land or stock or something that will itself generate more wealth. We don't do that. We don't have that. So this is again why we can't be looking at buying power as an assessment of our actual condition. We just go to work, we get paid, and then we take that paycheck and give it right away to somebody else. That's it. That's not wealth. So they're saying to you, at least honestly, this is not a measurement of wealth. We're only talking to businesses who hire us to produce these reports so that they can better market to different communities to get us to buy their product. So they know when you're watching whatever TV show, put the commercial with the black family in it on at 8 o'clock on this channel, because we know. You've seen it at the movie theater. You go to see the black movie and all of a sudden the previews are all these other black films you didn't even know existed. And then you go see the Avengers and all the previews are all the white films. I mean, it's the same way. It's just marketing. It has nothing to do with... All right. So as I'm saying, buying power is a marketing phrase that refers only to the power of consumers to purchase what are strictly available goods. And I know we're in an African-centered space, but Karl Marx is right when he says that those who own the means of production are those who are in power. Those who own the products you are buying are those who have the power. The consumer of those products is not in power. All right. So again, this is how that report works. So in that report, you have this statement from the report's creators. The reports have become widely respected industry chronicles touted for their exclusive insights, data trends, and perspectives that better prepare marketers and brands to connect with this audience segment. Mm-hmm. So again, they're telling you what this is for. Now, we read the headline, and we run off, and people go get speeches and get applause lines about how we have all this money and we just don't spend it correctly. And again, part of the reason this myth is so strong is because there's been a history of great people among our community misreading it. So it's Malcolm X's birthday. With all due respect to Malcolm X, he misread this. And in his speeches, you can catch him making reference to buying power and spending power and misreading it. Dr. King missed this point. Claude Anderson continues to miss this point. Boyce Watkins not only misses this point, but I think quite in a hustler fashion tries to sell you something to convince you that he's right. So he tries to convince you that to buy his business model, practice, whatever he's selling, to show you that you have more money than you have. And he's completely wrong.
Teach.
Who else? There are a lot of... Minister Farrakhan incorrectly references this routinely. And, you know, I love him to death. My older brother, former minister of the Baltimore Mosque here. I've reached out to him on a number of occasions. But, brother, you know, can we get to the minister? Like, can we just get him to stop saying this one thing? I don't want to get into any other arguments, and I'm not beefing with the nation. I just want this one little thing, because he's just wrong on this one point. And I always hate it when I see that, because it always sounds like people are talking to their own community and saying, you all are stupid, you all are lazy, you all are backward, and that's not why you're poor. So it's just that one little thing that they're wrong. I'm not saying. So I just added this the other day because this is just another example quickly of how it works. So this study came out on Marketplace. Again, a news report on NPR's Marketplace talking about black women leading this black buying power thing. You don't have to read all of this, or if you want, I'll make it available. You can have it. But I troll, I admit it. I kind of mess with people. I emailed the author of the story. And I just simply said, in your recent story on buying power, you make reference to specific data points on two occasions, and I asked her for her sources. She wrote back, and this is again, on the right-hand side, you can see what she wrote here, and this is exactly my point. Thanks for getting in touch. Here's a link to the Nielsen report. You'll have to click download on the right-hand side to put your information to download the report. The Selig Center study, unfortunately, is only available by purchase. I referenced their statistics that were available in their public press release and confirmed it with Jeff Humphreys of the Selig Center, who worked on the report. Hope this helps. I wrote to Jeff Humphreys and said, you know, I'm also doing a story, and this reporter suggests I reach out to you, and could you tell me where these numbers come from and walk me through it for my report? He has never responded. That's since February. But my point here is that the national press quickly takes this stuff about black buying power reaching $1.2 trillion or $1.5 trillion by 2021. But when you ask them for their sources, it all, like all of them, goes back to Nielsen and the Selig Center. That's all of them, everywhere. Target Market News, all of their stuff goes back to these two sources. And as I'm trying to show you here, those sources are completely flawed and wrong, or they're interpreted wrong by the people quoting these numbers.
And I was just also saying that it's biased because they are coming from companies that actually produce these studies.
Yeah, well, yes and no. I would say the bias initially... Well, yes, the bias initially is that Nielsen and the Selig Center are producing these reports specifically for sale to big corporations who want this data so that they can market to various communities. So that's the bias. The bias is we're not talking to black people, number one. We're definitely not talking to black people about their actual economic condition. We're talking to each other about how to get their money. What little bit they have left at the end of the day, we want it. All right? We intercept these messages or have them brought to us as headlines, and then we get excited. And we don't check the data. We don't do the research. We just regurgitate the number. We got all this money. Why aren't we spending it properly? You know who got it right? My main man, George Jackson. And this is why he's the least talked about leader maybe that we've ever had. George Jackson assassinated in 1971 in either Soledad Brother or his other one, Blood in My Eye. He said, they keep telling us we have this purchasing power, but then they just add inflation to go with it so that increase in purchasing power doesn't have any effect on anything. So you get more money to spend, but they just raise, like what Dr. King said, I integrate the lunch counter, but the hamburger that used to be 25 cents is now $2.25. So they don't have to say no niggas allowed. They just say the rent is now $1,500 a month. Bye. See you. I'm out. That's what they did to my efficiency in D.C. They pulled out the fine print that said, by the way, you didn't read this part, but it says we can jack your price, your rent up 1,000%. And that's what's about to happen. So they didn't have to say, you know, no half niggas allowed. They just said, this is, your rent's going up. Bye. And I was on my way. Huh?
I just said it happened to the whole city of D.C.
Oh, yeah, the whole city of D.C. Exactly. I mean, that's gentrification in microcosm. That's all they say. They don't have to put the signs up anymore. Like my man said, my man Head Rock in D.C. said, as soon as you see the Gold's Gym, you just know. And Whole Foods is next. Bye, everybody. All right, so the third myth. All right, so as I said, the myth functions as propaganda because primarily what ends up happening is that we are convinced that we're poor because we're just not spending our money properly. And then we don't challenge or redirect our efforts to collective work that addresses the political system. And one of the things that we fail to understand is that wealth is created by state policy, by public policy, by politics. So the interest rates that create the value of your money, the who can buy land, who can invest, all of these are political decisions that if we're not organized, we'll never, this is not something you can individually do as a business thing. It has to be a collective model. So one thing that comes up all the time, and somebody, you know, is, well, why don't we do like the Asians do and open up restaurants? You gotta look at the history of Chinese restaurants. Chinese restaurants are Chinese and U.S. collective state projects. These are not individual entrepreneurs working out of their desperate situation and doing something we're too stupid and lazy to do. The Chinese and U.S. set policy. Going back, they even said the only way, going back to the early or the mid-1900s, they said the only way Chinese people can come into this country is if they're coming as business people. So the Chinese government set up a situation where they gave loans to their own people to set up businesses in the United States, which were matched by other financial benefits from this country to set up all these Chinese restaurants. Public policy, politics, it is not about black people being too lazy and stupid to open up a restaurant. Now, this is a video, I'll skip it for now, but Antonio Moore does a great job of just explaining how race and wealth are separate in a 60-second video that we can just sort of look at, as I just say a word or two about it. But it just simply just shows you where all the money is and how little of it black people actually have. So that when you start to hear these issues of or questions about buying power, it's a little more easy to see behind or past all the mythology.
Is there a reason why we can't watch it?
The audio wasn't set up. But essentially he's just saying that there are no black millionaires. There are a bunch of white millionaires, 8.5 family white millionaires, and almost no black billionaires. And even if when there are black billionaires, that means very little for the collective. So this is why I keep saying, like, I don't care about any more black rich people. Because a few black rich people does not, this is where all the money, all the families that have all the real money in this country. I think it's 20% of all the black wealth. No, yeah, 20% of black America has 50% of what little wealth black people have. So even within the black community, there's this huge gap. You have a few rich celebrities and business people, and then that's about it. And then they get a crazy amount of attention, which makes us think A, that we can do it, and that B, that's going to be helpful to us. And it's just doesn't work that way. And it's not because they're celebrities and they're just bad people once they become rich. It's that there's just not enough money to be spread around to help people. So as Derek Hamilton and William Barity have said, much of the framing around wealth disparity, including the use of alternative financial service products, focuses on the poor financial choices and decision-making on the part of largely black, Latino, and poor borrowers, which is often tied to a culture of poverty thesis regarding an undervaluing and low acquisition of education. Race is a stronger predictor of wealth than class itself. For instance, blacks and Latinos collectively make up about 30% of the U.S. population, but collectively they only have about 7% of the nation's private wealth. So what they're saying and they're arguing in their report is your racial identity, more than anything else, is more of a predictor as to whether or not you're going to be wealthy. And black people being shut out of the wealth-producing mechanisms in this country have no wealth to pass down to anybody, which is why we don't have any wealth. And creating wealth from nothing is virtually impossible at this point. So I'll end this way, and then hopefully we can clarify some things in Q&A. But in the original commentary I wrote 10 years ago, I ended it this way because I really wanted to highlight this point. Anyone, including black leaders, who parade fanciful numbers before their unsuspecting audiences so as to again suggest that irresponsibility is the cause of black poverty need to be checked vigorously. We need to get back to an increased intelligent and honest discussion of economics so we can be where Kwame Ture was when he left. As he and his comrades always said when answering a phone or when saying goodbye, ready for the revolution. So that's all I'm trying to say here today. I hope I made some sense and was clear enough, moving somewhat quickly, but I want to end with what I said at the beginning. I don't have all the solutions. I'm only arguing that the myth of buying power is indeed a myth, that we don't have any money that will that can be collectively redistributed to satisfy the inequality that we have. We have to understand how capitalism works, that it requires political movement and organization, that money and policy are determined by politics, not by economic decision making. And that if we don't deal with this myth or challenge this as a solution, actual solutions that we need to develop won't ever be considered. All right, so I'll stop there. Thank you very much again for listening, and I'm happy to engage you in the Q&A.